Hi, I'm Samiran.
Hi, I'm Nilesh.
Hi, I'm Sheetal. And you're listening to 3TB.
Three Techies Banter.
So, hi everyone, I'm Sheetal and welcome to 3TB, a podcast where three techies banter. It is a podcast where you can explore tech in the non-tech way. It's about how the tech and the economics behind the tech impact us today and in the future. It is full of information, fun facts, common sense, and is actually spoken in a language that everybody can understand. Today, we're going to talk about a topic which is quite interesting. It's been in the news. India has been talking about it, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, one of the things when I do a lot of research and I speak to people when we talk about tech, one of the big questions that is, or one of the statements that I hear almost always inevitably is, my phone listens to me. I hate it when my phone listens to me. And, you know, they'll tell you things like, I was talking about going and buying a Raymond suit with, you know, a friend. And then next I know on my Instagram and my other platforms, I start seeing ads of Instagram. And I know my phone is listening to me. And that really is very interesting because is the phone really listening to you? Is just the phone listening to you? What does a phone listening to you mean? And I think that triggers off a lot of concerns around security and privacy. And today's conversation is going to be around privacy and security, but I'm going to let Nilesh define how we have decided to take this up. Because we all think, and especially I think all consumers think security and privacy is a pain. So Nilesh, over to you.
Yes, thanks, Sheetal. You are absolutely right. I mean, if you talk to any security professional or person who is in this field, they will call it, for multiple reasons, the acronym pain, and it is a pain in, you know, the backside, getting the security to the right levels. But before I jump into defining security, I'll just, you know, to continue on the thought you mentioned. In our season one, we talked about it, I think, in one of the episodes, that, you know, when you say that my phone is listening to me or the devices are, you know, ingesting data from your life, honestly, that's truth. And there is this whole, whole school of thought, which says economic school of thought, which is called surveillance capitalism. And this term was actually coined by a professor from Harvard, calling it a surveillance capitalism, whereby, you know, a lot of data is being collected supposedly for your benefit. To coming back to defining security and why we call security is a pain. Security can, I mean, should have, it may not be having, but it should have four kind of pillars that it needs to comply when you analyze the level of security provided to you. First, so we use the acronym PAIN. There are different acronyms available in the industry. People use different various ones. I love PAIN. Security is a pain. So the P stands for privacy. P stands for privacy. A stands for authenticity. I stands for integrity. And N stands for non-repudiation. In this episode, we'll kind of cover the privacy aspect of it. So what we decided was that, you know, security is such an important aspect. India also, you know, after a long time, we have that whole digital DPDP Act, right? Data Protection Act. And we are at that state where we should kind of peel the layers and define people what is security. And with whole our favorite thing, blockchain, Web3, we are getting into that era where people are concerned about their security. So we'll do a couple of episodes. Today we'll talk of essentially privacy, and then we'll move on to the, A, I, and N aspects of it.
So on to privacy and some fun stuff. I mean, having fun with privacy. So when I started thinking about this topic, you know, I remember what my convent educated mother and mother-in-law used to say. They used to tell me that walls have ears and ears have toes, and this is how the message goes. So basically that, you know, you should always talk in hushed tones so that nobody gets to know what you're saying. So that's how we grew up, frankly. So, you know, but so we always crave that little mystery. And that's how we are in our real lives, right? You know, we lock our bathrooms. We hide our browser history, probably for our significant others. We don't dream about leaving our house in our pajamas or undergarments or whatever it is. But we are happy to hop online and, you know, start spilling our deepest secrets, financial woes, embarrassing childhood photographs, you know, some questionable musical preferences, what have you. So, you know, I mean, if this feels like a kind of a contradiction, you know, this is essentially the privacy paradox that, you know, your behavior in one place is one, but when you go into another dimension, you know, it completely changes and, you know, people are just not able to explain why this happened. In this episode, what we thought we'll do, that we will be asking some tough questions, just like Rajdeep Sajdesai does in his evening news. So one of them is, why is privacy more important today than ever before? You know, why is it, you know, that, you know, we need to be careful when as we step into this digital world, you know, and many digital worlds, so to speak. So the second thing is that, is it really possible to be private? You know, when you are, you know, you are so connected and you want to be connected. And in fact, Nilesh, I was just thinking about this whole Metcalfe's law here, that the fact that, you know, you have this end race to the power to connection. So every time you connect, you are getting multiple connections. And doing that, how can you even remain private? And why should you even care? You know, I mean, why should you even care that privacy is important? And, you know, what is going to happen to you if people know about you? So I think those are some of the questions we'll kind of try and decipher and unpeel. You know, what's the psychology of this? You know, is there a real cost of sharing your data? Maybe some practical strategies. And during the course of this, we'll probably, I'm sure we'll stray a little from the topic. But then I'll kind of pin all of that on Sheetal and Nilesh. For me, it was just asking the tough questions. So I think in the physical world, we were brought up to be, you know, private, and, you know, your family is one unit and then the outside world and your school, and you tend to keep everything compartmentalized. And I think that's how it was. But I think come the internet, which was one, and then come, I think, Facebook, and, you know, maybe before that it was all those chat rooms and all of that, where, you know, you started talking to unknown people, and, you know, maybe it just started with asking questions, and it was FAQs, and maybe it was coding help and all. And slowly, slowly, you started collaborating and you realized, oh, this is fun. And then you felt, you know, no harm in, you know, exposing a little more of my life. And I think there is the dichotomy, really, is that while you are exposing private things, you feel, because it's an unknown person, it's like your therapist, right? So because it's unknown, you are safe. But that's not really, I mean, as time has told you, it's not really true. I mean, very difficult to figure out why people do it, but they, I mean, nobody seems to care, which is the worry. And obviously, the other thing which has fueled this problem is the fact that the internet, since it was not built for transactions, and it had to figure out its own revenue model, and they realized that data was the revenue model. So, you know, we were not making money because people were doing business, but everybody said, I have got this great amount of data about everything that people do, and there is another group of people who are interested, so let me sell it. And then, you know, and I think so that in virtuous cycle grew, I think, that, you know, people kind of did all kinds of shitty stuff.
That provides me, you know, because you mentioned, Samiran, about data, and that became the monetization model. But you gave me a great segue related to data, right? And I think the best, I find it the best. I don't know whether I hope our listeners, some of them have read the Cypherpunk's manifesto. And if not, they should. And Cypherpunk's manifesto essentially gave birth to blockchain, honestly. So this was written by Eric Hughes. He's one of the top, you know, cryptographers of, you know, of this century, I'll say. And he and many others, these are all professors at, you know, MIT and in the top colleges. And one of the days, this guy said, this group actually decided, it was written by Eric Hughes, he wrote a manifesto. Right. And in that, the first paragraph of Cypherpunk's manifesto is actually definition of privacy. And I like it. I mean, it's very nice. It's very, and I'll quote it verbatim. Privacy is necessary for an open society in the electronic age. Privacy is not secrecy. A private matter is something one doesn't want the whole world to know. But a secret matter is something one doesn't want anybody to know. So as per Eric Hughes, privacy is the power to selectively reveal oneself to the world. Now, that is the that actually summarizes the issue which we're starting off this whole data and you know, flouting of privacy, that it's you know, the selective is the keyword here, right? Very simple example. When I go to a bar, right, and I have to prove my age to get a drink, let's say, you know, you end up flashing either your, you know, license or Aadhaar card or whatever identity document. Essentially, you have given away all the information, right? The person just needed to know whether you were 18. Similarly, one beautiful example in the manifesto was that how were transactions happening in real world, right? If I went to buy a pencil or a pen in a stationery store, I go there, I choose my pen, I pay in cash maybe, and take the pen home. Did the person know my name, my address, my date of birth? Today, when you do even a transaction on an e-commerce website, you are not, while you are buying a pen, you have given a whole lot away to the vendor, right? So that selective was the very interesting part.
So in fact, Nilesh, that you mentioned, was that is something that I went for FTX, you know, that Razorpay's annual event. And so while there was a lot of excitement with, you know, that they've done some $150 billion of money has passed through their system and 250 million people have used, blah, blah. But they have now suddenly decided that payment is at one end. We are going to address the whole journey of the buyer. Okay. And now they have data on everything and they're saying, oh, you know, we will make the checkout easier and we will make the selection easier and we will improve dropout from carts for our vendors. And, you know, and everybody is excited. All B2B guys are super excited. Okay. Now we've got this. But what about the consumer? I mean, you know, now you're making it more and more difficult. And all of this is because of, I don't know if I'm willingly giving it for this purpose. Okay. I am giving Razorpay, I'm giving data to pay, but I am not allowing them to use this for now making other people successful. You know, so which is like a very strange thing. I said, I mean, what are they doing exactly?
So I think which is one of the reasons why there has been such a hue and cry around data and data privacy, because what you give data for versus how that data is getting used is where the problem lies, right? And I think that's where privacy acts and privacy norms become very, very critical, because somebody has to start holding organizations responsible. But I think it's also about individuals realizing what they're giving away. I think the challenge is, and you know, Samiran, you have talked about this in one of our earlier episodes, is that in our haste to want a service, right, we all just agree to any terms and conditions, right? And we don't ever read all of the terms and conditions simply because it's too long. I remember you only sent us the Visual Capitalist link where it talks about the length of the privacy documents or the terms and agreement sheets of various companies and how long it would take for people to, you know, read that document if they really read it end to end.
It's 250 hours for all Americans if they want to read every digital contract. That's the average. Somebody's calculated it. 250 hours if you want to know what you're giving away.
And I love the fact that Microsoft's terms and conditions is like equivalent to reading a Shakespeare's book. It's that many hours, right? It's an hour plus, but it's like reading a book versus reading a contract. So I think the challenge is that today, the consumer willingly is giving away data, okay, for things that they want without realizing what they have signed off. And I think that's the big challenge. So I don't know, but in nowhere in the world, but in relation to India especially, you go to any company, any large building where a company has an office, at the reception, you walk in and the first thing they ask you, your name, your mobile number, your company. I'm like, dude, why do you need all of this? Why do you need to store my mobile number? Why do you need all of that? If you, and what are you doing with that data? How are you utilizing that data? And it's even funnier, Samir, and I don't know if you and I were having this conversation or we were having this conversation where I go to a building in BKC and they have this physical book, right? Where you walk in, you put your name, your telephone number. They also ask you for your Aadhaar or PAN or whatever number. They will ask you to put your laptop, details, all of that. And it was very shocking for me that those books just get disposed of in Raddi.
Are you, what about those police diaries outside Santa Cruz station where they used to take down your name and mobile number? Kutez I say, what number? Are you, what?
So, you know, police though, I still think you don't, an average Joe doesn't go every day. But these office buildings, you're filling in all of these details in this register. And I saw the register being given to Raddi. It killed me because now if somebody went there and started picking all of the data up, can you imagine what could happen?
So, Sheetal, I have to give you one example. So, you know, while we are talking about India, so I knew this whole India thing will come up. So I went and found one European example from this same stupidity. Okay. So anyway, so just like we thought that, you know, only Indians do strange things. I mean, it's true in Europe also. And that's why I thought we'll go and find this example. So in 2014, they actually, Europol, the European Law Enforcement Agency, did this experiment to prove that, kind of illustrated the dangers of public Wi-Fi. And somewhere embedded in that agreement was that if you can use Wi-Fi, but for that, your firstborn child will have to be given away to us for eternity. Okay. And they actually had 6 enrollments. I mean, fortunately, of course, they never enforced that agreement, but that's what happens when, you know, these agreements are also built to, I would say, deceive, or at least to kind of, you know, conceal. I won't say deceive, but at least it's just not out there. You know, you won't lead with, I will take away your child. You know, you'll say all nice things in some way. And, but by the way, somewhere, something is wrong.
So, you know, when I was listening to what you mentioned about, you know, buildings and when you enter and, you know, stuff like that, the amount of information give. And that is why what I said, I love the Cypherpunk's manifesto as privacy is the power to selectively reveal oneself to the world, right? You need to know why you need and just take that part of the information, right? And Samiran, you mentioned about this event, you know, I find it ridiculous. I mean, I'm not saying RazorPay or someone is at fault, but the fact is, if I am doing a payment transaction in the real world, I would go to a shopkeeper. He'll not know my name also, right? I'll just give him cash, or even if I give him credit card, he doesn't know anything beyond the payment instrument that was presented, and he should be giving me the services or goods, right? So somehow, and maybe to give the benefit of doubt to all the surveillance capitalists, maybe internet was not designed to manage this flaw. Right. So firstly, it was not designed for transactions. So people started thinking how to monetize, and then data was flowing freely and the whole packet of data was flowing. Right. You could not selectively do stuff. Correct. And when you're sitting, it's like when you're sitting on this gold mine, why not monetize it? Right. I mean, correct, there was correct, no way correct. To segregate it.
So, you know, it's interesting, Nilesh, because I think a lot of, and I think of it as a consumer, a lot of it happened because the internet gave you services. So think about it at your offline transaction itself, right? If you went to your vegetable vendor and you said, ghar pe bhej do, send it home, right? Then he would tell you, give me your name, give me your address, right? And inevitably, he took your telephone number because his man was going to get lost and somebody had to call you up to check out whether how to get there. You were giving information, right? Even in the offline space. Because I think we started giving data for conveniences that we were seeking. Even whether it was offline or whether it was online. I think the whole worry about privacy and the worry about it happens with the online space because of the scale at which it happens. If my vegetable vendor has my telephone number, my home address, and my first name, I mean, there's very little chances that my house is going to get raided because now he doesn't know because of my GPS that I'm not at home or I'm sitting somewhere outside. He doesn't have all the other data pieces that would make that data vulnerable. I think the challenge between the offline and the online is the online when you have so much data, the vulnerabilities increase tremendously. That's it.
So I think my mother must have been an espionage agent or something in her previous life. Because when we got, she was very privacy conscious, you know. So I remember when we got married, we were trying to order home delivery. And she told us, tell them to deliver it to the watchman. That way they won't know which flat you live in. I said, wow, this is cool, man. now I know, I mean, why she was doing it after in the age of Facebook. But I think some of this, like you mentioned, Sheetal, we kind of bring upon ourselves, right? The fact that at one level, we love the personalization and the fact that, oh, you know, they know exactly what I want and, you know, I'm getting. And then you say, oh, now they know everything about me. So, you know, so I think we have to, as individuals also, draw that line between what we want in terms of personalization and that extra care versus what we're willing to give for it. Because ultimately, that personalization is coming from your own data. They are not getting personalization from somewhere else, right? I mean, it's they're personalizing for you because you bought a samosa yesterday. Today, you take two samosas. They are not going to give you a banana now. I mean, that's the issue, right?
But, you know, so I don't know, Nilesh, in the offline world, I remember my bhajiwala, every time I would call him up to place an order, he would say, but, lucky bhi chahiye, ye bhi chahiye, wo bhi chahiye. He's reminding me of all the things that I'd ordered the previous time to trigger so, me off to say, that's exactly what Amazon does.
I agree,
right?
But, you know, my worry only is that we worry that at aggregate levels and all that, they are influencing you, they are selling. So that Bhajiwala's data is also very good. By the way, I love the neighborhood brick and mortar. But that's truly your convenience. And he's not telling your neighbor, pata hai, Sheetal ne kal baigan kharida tha. You know, what will you give me for that data?
Correct. That's precisely the point I was making, Samiran, that, you know, in the offline world, that data was okay because you could not manipulate using that data. I think the challenges and the reason why there's such a hue and cry is not just about collecting the data. I think it's about how you're using the data, how AI, ML, all the other technologies are being used to influence people who can be influenced, right? There is a time when I think all of us will really not be thinking the way we would have originally thought had we not had all of this in our lives, right? Today, you and I are, I mean, Amazon's throwing up everything that you want. You never go beyond the second page. You never go and search for something. In the offline world, you would have browsed through the whole store before you arrived at what you wanted to do. I think it's the capability at scale. And that's the worry, right? If it was one-on-one, it's a different thing. But the capability to influence behavioral change at scale is where this whole data issue becomes larger than life. And that's what one needs to worry about, especially when it comes to younger children, the amount of time that they're spending, all of that.
As Nilesh mentioned, I think we need to look at the way privacy should be addressed or managed at probably three levels. One is actually at the national level or at a global level, which is typically done by regulation or laws. And I think every country, I mean, the US has laws, Europe has laws, India has its own Data Privacy Act. And in fact, it was kicked off by a 2017 Supreme Court judgment, which recognized privacy as a fundamental right. So there is a whole framework. But I think below that framework or coupled with it, we also need to have the technology companies or the large players take responsibility for what they are doing with the data. Because just having the framework in place is not going to help, because there has to be a privacy by design element here, which means that we cannot go and build privacy into a system at the end if it was designed to extract data. So, you know, it's like any simple software project, and you know, it has to be corrected first. You know, you have to kind of inject privacy into that design, which is, I think, will primarily fall in the court of the big tech or tech companies. And I think third, which is, I think, important and actionable, is what we should be aware of and what we can do to at least protect ourselves at the individual level, because obviously, you know, you and I are not going to be changing laws, and we are not going to be sending petitions over to big tech, you know, that you stole my data. You know, of course, you can do that, but nothing's going to come out of it. So at the individual level, what you can do, because I still remember this very funny example somebody had given me, is that, you know, he had asked me this question about, you know, what is the function of the lock in your house? So I said, oh, protect me, you know. He said, no, the function of the lock in your house is that the robber will go to your neighbor. So the only thing is that if you protect yourself. So I think we're not trying to get other people's data stolen. But the issue is that if each individual protects themselves, then the problem will be that much more contained and controlled. And if maybe if data is not so easily available, then people will figure out a way to, you know, do something and fix it, and or say, okay, you know, maybe there'll be monetization of data. And, you know, to our other example of, you know, maybe there'll be some decentralized way, and we can, each individual can become a data entrepreneur or whatever have you. But I think at those three levels, I think is what we need to kind of look at this problem.
So Samiran, you're absolutely right. You know, at the three levels, the first one has to be regulation, regulatory authorities, government, etc. But I think one of the challenges that happen with very often with regulation, regulatory authorities is, do they take into account voices of everyone, right? So the DPDP Act has come into being. It took you, like you mentioned, you know, it started in 2017 with the Supreme Court passing a judgment, and then we had a act, you know, a proposal that was there, a bill, and that didn't get passed because it had a lot of issues around it. And it's only in 2023 that we've now had the DPDP Act. I think while the government does this, it's the challenge I feel is that a lot of us as consumers don't get involved with these acts. We don't even read them to understand what our rights are. And therefore, we continue to stay with, and we'll make continue to make the mistakes because we've not even read these acts and we don't know what our rights are. And when it comes to technology and digital, etc., I think it's important that we, all of us, at least read the act, try and understand what our fundamental rights are. So it's nice to say I have the right to privacy, but what does that right to privacy entail? What are you allowed? What are you not allowed? Where can you, you know, take action? Where can't you take action? Those are things that us as average consumers never try and get into. But I think that's one of the big things that need to happen, because that's when the pressure goes on to the large tech companies, etc., to say, okay, I really have to make change, because it is important to make change and not just because it's a regulation. I think so. We leave it at that. But Nilesh, I know you have some very interesting new technologies which are getting developed to help, you know, individuals and companies resolve these issues of data privacy and what data and how to collect data and how to manage data. So all over to you.
So like you, Samiran defined those three levels, right? And like you mentioned, even after regulations, it falls on the tech companies, how they implement them and safeguard these, the individual privacy issues and stuff like that. But what I thought I'll talk about it is that, are there technologies that help you do that, right? And cryptography is the obvious one. But it's not that today when we have a secure interaction with a website, right? It is mostly, if you see the URL on top, it will be HTTPS, which is a secure HTTP. Every data that is flowing over the wire, as they say, is encrypted. But in the end, the data still reaches from the source to the destination, right? And when it reaches the destination, the ownership is with the destination to do whatever they want with the data. So to solve that, there are various frameworks available in cryptography. And one of the holy grails of cryptography, literally people talk, is ZKP, or zero knowledge proof, right? And it's fantastic concept. I mean, when I first read about ZKP, and we implemented it in a way in our blockchain protocol, I just loved it the first time I read it. The idea is that, you know, zero knowledge proof is that you prove whether you need to prove your identity or you need to prove your elements of your identity, you prove it without passing any information, right? So this is like literally a holy grail. And let me, simple example of this. In today's world, when you have a username and password, password is actually stored somewhere, right? So whenever you are entering a website, whatever you enter in the password field is actually compared with the password stored with them, right? So in a way, you have given away the knowledge, you have passed the knowledge of your secrecy to the website, and they just compare it, and that is how you move. Even biometric, honestly, right? It is a pattern match. You put, someone has to store your, even in Aadhaar, somewhere there is a repository of your retinal scan and fingerprints, and it is always something called scoring biometric. So you take the print again, you take the pattern again, you match it. If it is more than 80%, you assume this is the person who, he or she is saying himself to be. So zero knowledge proof, classic example would be, take an example that a person goes to a bar, I'm using from the first section again, and I have to prove my age, that I'm above 18 to have a drink, or about 25 mark to have a drink. Now you show a license, or you show some way that your age is proven. What if the government decided to give a digital token whenever you turn 18? Right? I'm not going into the details, but if securely you were able to give a digital token or a digital check mark the moment you became an adult, right? As per the definition of that country. Honestly, we could do that with Aadhaar. Every, you know, 97% people in India have Aadhaar, right? Every kid has Aadhaar. Could it be that instead of in Aadhaar authentication, you could return a green check mark versus a yellow check mark? You know, and a green would be that the guy is added, just that much, right? Now, if this digital token is secure and only you possess it, you could give this digital token to the guy. He doesn't need to know your name. He doesn't need to know where you live. You just proved that you are above 18. So this is a zero knowledge proof. Again, going back to selectively revealing yourself or selectively using the elements of your identity. And one very quick example I'll take before I finish is some of the implementations are already there. And one country which is at forefront of e-governance and digital initiatives is Estonia. Estonia has actually implemented decentralized identity for its citizens. And they have provided the mechanisms or the principles of ZKP, whereby you selectively reveal your identity for the specific purpose. So a simple example is that if I want to, search for employment, then my education is necessary. But that guy doesn't need to know my address. Similarly, so that selective, so you have your identity has multiple parameters and access, and you pick and choose and reveal the parameter that is required for a certain activity. So I think ZKP is a very promising technology for that.
That would be fascinating, because think about it, we are stepping into elections, and imagine if you could go and vote without revealing identity. At this point in time, you're revealing everything, right? So you could, it makes it so much safer. It makes it so much better from an election point of view, because what do you need to tell somebody when you're going to vote? That you have the right to vote.
And plus the whole migrant population, right? This we have been trying to solve this forever, that you can vote from anywhere once for anyone, in the sense.
And honestly, that voting is such a fantastic use case, Sheetal, since you mentioned. Voting is a secret ballot. So I was recently reading an article about the whole facade that happened in Chandigarh, I don't know, mayoral elections. The Supreme Court, one of the way your ballot is considered invalidated is if you reveal your identity. So then why the hell are you taking my identity to give vote, right? Other than my age.
Yeah, voter ID. All you need to know is I am from this country, and you need to know that I'm of age. That's all that you need to know, and I should be allowed to vote. And I think this is an amazing thing.
This is the makings of an election paradox now. Reveal, like, it's actually like that, right? If you reveal it, it is invalid, but you have to vote, you have to reveal. So it's like a complete loop.
Yeah, so I can almost think of all the various reasons, you know, things that you could do with this. I also think it'll shift the balance of power in the hands of the user. At least that's my understanding from what I've read up on it. I think we will shift the balance of power a little bit towards the user deciding what I'm giving you for what services I want. And that, I think, is a very, very... And charge for it.
You know,
Samiran, I'm not this person who, I hear this in my research very often nowadays. Everybody's talking about, you know, companies should pay me for my data, dude, but they're giving you other services. So that's a debate. right? Because then will you start paying companies for their services if you want to not give data? And that's a very, very tricky piece for me. Every research I do, I feel like, you know, there is, you ask anybody saying, are you willing to pay for the service? So then they won't take your data. The answer inevitably is no, I want the service free and I want to make sure that they don't use my data. I think that's a bit of a messy place for me, at least on a debate point of view.
I'm quite hopeful, honestly, that when you look at the India stack and there are elements of decentralization already in it. So I'm quite hopeful that India will move towards that. I mean, after the DPDP Act and the kind of stuff that is happening, DigiLocker, there is this whole design in mind that there is an India blockchain initiative happening, honestly. So this whole thing may lead there. So having covered the country, government or regulation aspect and the fact that companies and technology can also help to implement privacy element of security. I think we should quickly, before we wrap up, we should talk about what individuals can do. And I can start with one example, which happened recently, right? And which is, and I was not aware of it. So someone hacked one of our friends in one of my WhatsApp groups and posed as that person to ask for some monetary help. And this is a college group, and a couple of people actually ended up sending some money because they thought they are talking to our friend, and he is in US and he was asking for money in India. So friends in India helped out. It was a complete fraud. The person, my friend had lost in US, lost control of his WhatsApp, and some guy took that control and used that to get money, right? And about, not a lot, but two people ended up sending $50,000 each and stuff like that. Now, what we realized that day, in the group itself, someone posted that, guys, do you know that WhatsApp can be secured through a kind of a second factor authentication? And since we all have WhatsApp on our phone and we go by the fact that our phone is secured through biometric and stuff like that, we don't even care about it. But whenever you shift your phone, you have to move your WhatsApp, and there are those vulnerabilities where someone can hijack it. And the moment it is hijacked, you stop getting your WhatsApp messages and that person or a device starts getting it. How can you secure yourself? Just enable that. It is in the settings. And the moment you enable, what it does is it prompts you password. It doesn't prompt you password every day, but it prompts you password when you change a device, or after some few days, it prompts you password. So you cannot enter WhatsApp without putting that PIN or whatever the secret code you chose. And that is just one small way of ensuring that your WhatsApp is not hacked or hijacked.
So similarly, I was, constantly, because in research, I keep hearing this, my phone listens to me, my paranoia went up, right? And therefore, I said, is there some way? So you can't foolproof it completely because you're giving away a lot of rights to a lot of things. But one of the things that you could do possibly to stop your phone from listening is actually open the Google app. Tap on your profile image on the top right. In the settings, you go to Google Assistant and General and just toggle off Google Assistant. And, so you could possibly turn off the microphone on your phone by doing just something as simple as that. So that's something else that you could possibly look at. So on my phone, for example, it's toggled off. And I try and keep it away. Also, there's also simple things like put your phone far away. Because it can only listen to over a certain distance and things like that. But toggle off your Google Assistant and voice.
So I think another real nuisance post GDPR has been this whole cookie acceptance, right? And just while it sounds very innocuous and we typically just do accept all and go through, what cookies really do is they capture your browser information, pages visited, blah, blah, personal information, address, phone number, user preferences, shopping information, and whole bunch of other stuff, and then their first party cookies, third party. So I think just as a simple rule, you should kind of go in and do manage preferences and only take the necessary ones or just reject all. There are tons of ways to do it. There are cookie blocking extensions. You can do it through Chrome or any other browser setting. So just some simple safeguards there. The other couple of things that kind of stay in people's mind is, especially in India, is Aadhaar and UPI. So for Aadhaar, I think we had talked about this, but just to repeat that, when you're giving a physical copy of an Aadhaar, masked Aadhaars are available. So, you know, don't give the Aadhaar with all the numbers. Aadhaar has the provision to do virtual IDs. So you don't have to give your Aadhaar. The virtual ID also maps to your Aadhaar, through which validation can take place. You have the ability to lock or unlock your biometrics. So what that does, of course, is that nobody else can use that to validate you anywhere, but your Aadhaar remains safe. And another good practice is, I think you can always go through your Aadhaar authentication history. I think it keeps a list of your last 50 transactions. So if you see some funny business, you know, again, you know, just a safeguard. For UPI, obviously the simple one is don't give your PIN to anybody, which is the easy one. The other one, I think, which is UPI recommended, and I can, there's something called UPI Shield, you can go read it, is that don't, you know, give the UPI, use the UPI to pay. Don't give UPI details for receiving money, you know. So I think that has been a big learning for people. For receiving is when people try to hijack stuff and, you know, all that mischief, and the Jamtara business starts working. So that is another simple thing. So at the individual level, you know, if these things are done, like I said, it's like the lock in your door. Probably you'll be safer.
Yeah, I think that kind of covers a lot of what you can do. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff on credit card safety and all of that. But I think every time you, one big learning I have is every time you start using new technology, research it enough to know where the challenges are going to be, how you can protect yourself, and how you can safeguard yourself, right? I think most of us get so excited with the technology that we forget that there could be inherent dangers in using that technology. So at least read up on it to know that for everything that you do, what is it that you're giving away and what is it that you're getting, including generative AI. I mean, I don't think any of us realizes how much we're feeding into Gen AI to learn for, with all the query searches that we're doing and things like that, and how much data of ourselves we are giving away, because you can actually get mapped, right, based on what you are searching on, the topics that you're, you know, kind of looking at. All of it, you're just adding to the capability of somebody to build a better profile on you. So get excited about Gen AI, use it, but also remember at the back of your mind that there is data which you're throwing away voluntarily and willingly for companies to use. So excitement is great, but caution is important.
So on that note, and you know, I know that Samiran is our biggest user of AI. So I don't know what all prompts and what AI picture Samiran as. I'm wondering now, who sometimes searches for, you know, sandwiches stuck in VCRs. But anyway, this brings us to the end of another episode of 3TB. If you liked our banter, then please share the episode and don't forget to follow the show. We are available on all major podcast platforms. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, then please do leave a rating and review. Thanks, and we'll keep on bringing some interesting stuff to you.